Post-Harlan Monologics, number 00063. Recorded on January 25, 2024. Production location, Post-Harlan, Texas. Doomsday. Chapter 63.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Yes, and coming to you from an undisclosed location in the city of Wylie, Texas, recorded live in the F-150 mobile studio. This here is Maverick 88, and you are listening to Post-Harlan Monologics, right? Post-Harlan Monologics. And in my lengthy hiatus through the fall and portion of the winter, you know, one thing of note that I did is I started to get a little bit into the ancestry on my mother's side, right? The maternal lines of ancestry. Something that was kind of poo-pooed by my father, the paternal figure, right? As if my mother was insignificant and therefore her side of the family was equally insignificant. It never mattered. It was all about that, and it was all about his family and his life and how great they are and shit like that, right? That was the basic atmosphere around the considerations for the exploration of our family history, right? But I decided to just go on ahead and start seeing what I could find out about that whole line. You see, my father's side, the Ukrainian line, very short. We don't have history going back. It's only word of mouth stuff going back two generations, you know, me plus two generations back, my grandparents. There's really little to say about my great-grandparents. And before that, there's nothing. Records are lost. The Soviets, the Bolsheviks, those scumbag communists who had this pension for torching Orthodox churches where all the records were kept for family stuff, births and marriages and deaths and, you know, sacraments otherwise and whatever, all up in flames, right? So there's really nothing to track back. And if there was anything to track back, it would be a language foreign to me, an alphabet foreign to me. I would definitely need some kind of assistance with all that, right? So anyway, but then on my mother's side, it's like I started to dig into some stuff. You know, who's my grandfather? Who was his father? I have no idea. Who's that guy's father? And then the mother, you know, the grandmother and all that stuff. And I got, like, just off the internet, all kinds of stuff, right? And it became very interesting. I started to tell my mother some of the stuff that I was finding, and she seemed very interested in it. So what I did for her was I got her like a year subscription. Not like, I got her a year subscription to Ancestry.com where she can have more resources to dig through this stuff and find out for herself things that she's interested in. You know, I went as far as I'm going with that for the meantime. Hopefully she'll find out some things that I didn't see, that I wasn't able to. Maybe I'll get her password and use her account at some point and dig around a little bit more, right? But some of the things I found out, without getting all into it, right, some of the things I found out was, like, we actually have quite the legacy of Pennsylvania, eastern Pennsylvania, like Pocono Mountain, Scranton area, coal mining history, right? We got some coal miners in the family from Pennsylvania, and also got some roots all the way down in Lancaster County. The possibility of even being some kind of Amish or Mennonite. I couldn't take it back far enough in that particular line to see whether or not that's true. But we got family lines that basically come from Europe and settled in eastern Pennsylvania from Nazareth, PA, right? In Bethlehem, same general area, over Scranton, down to, like I said, Lancaster County, right? I guess Lancaster specifically, the city over there. And so that's some of the stuff. One thing, like one prominent name on that side of the family is a name, Gothier is how we pronounce it here. G-O-T-H-I-E-R, right? Properly in French, it would be Gothier. And there's some people that have that name here spell it differently, right? A couple of variations of it, but the name is ultimately Gautier. And I found out that that comes from a place called Alsace or Alsace, or I don't know, A-L-S-A-C-E, right? I don't know the proper pronunciation, but I do know that people who come from that particular region of France are Alsatians, right? Alsatians. And that is a historically disputed territory. It's a border area of the northeast of France, right along, what's it, the Rhine River, and then Germany, right there, right? The Rhine River splits the two as it is now, I think, Germany and France. It's this border town in a disputed area, guns back and forth, depending on, you know, the politics and government of a particular time in history, right? But nonetheless, I got a line of, or out of Alsatia, and that came across like in the 1700s into the United States, right? So I did pretty good going back like a couple hundred years. I was surprised. It's a messy work. It's not easy. In fact, speaking of messy work, right, that surname, Gautier, in French, what that means is, drum roll, please, sewer worker. Gautier. That's your sewer worker. So not only am I the Dwayne Schneider of Post Arlen, Texas, I am also descended from Ed Norton of Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. And if you don't get that, that's a dual old school pop culture TV reference, right? Going back to the dreadful Norman Lear One Day at a Time program from the 70s, early 80s, and also way back in the early 50s, The Honeymooners, right? Ralph Cramden, Jackie Gleason, right? Ed Norton worked in the sewer, so yeah. We're like kin, Ed Norton and me. Ed Norton! It's just useless data eating up my brain space. You know, I'd like to just speak that away, like puke it out and be done with it and leave room for better stuff to occupy my brain waves. But so anyway, well, with the Gautier, right? G-O-T-H-I-E-R. With a name like that, right, you'd have to figure that I'm qualified as some kind of like OG, like old gangsta goth, right? Goth. Gothier. I'm gothier than the next guy, right? What's goth, right? Goth. It's a culture, a subculture, came out of, how do you say, we had punk rock, then you had post-punk. Post-punk was kind of a movement, an umbrella term for a whole lot of stuff that filled the void following the end or the decline and end of the quote-unquote punk rock era, starting like in the late 70s, right? A lot of things blossomed at that point in time, and some other things died off in that point of time. We moved from, and you've heard me talk about this before, we moved from the analog age into the digital age. Things started to change. Then we got into the video stuff right on top of all that too, right? Whole new ball game for quote unquote rock and roll as it was. But in the 70s, in that void, that absence following the heyday of punk rock, right? The original Ramones and Sex Pistols and all that stuff. You had this kind of what they call a quote-unquote movement come along, right? The movement, it was called post-punk, and within that, punk people started to get a little bit more artsy-fartsy, right? Instead of just playing that straight-up punk music, they started to go in different directions with their creativity, and amongst those avenues that evolved within that umbrella of post-punk was gothic rock, right? Gothic rock. Now, I never really listened to gothic rock. I see what some of the names of the performers, the artists, were in the original rendition of gothic rock by name. Susie and the Banshees. I've seen that before. I have no idea. I don't think I ever heard a song. I don't know, right? Completely removed from all that stuff. But there's a whole culture built up around this, right? And that's why I use that word goth. When we say goth now in post-Arlen, Texas in 2024, most people in America will have a pretty good idea what we're talking about, right? We're talking about that real dark, gloomy teenage kid that has a lot of social and psychological issues, who's walking around dressed in black, dyes his hair black, never goes out in the sun. Basically a vampire, right? Basically a vampire. I used to think of people like that, a vampire or a ghoul, right? I guess more recently, like in the 2000s, they started becoming emo. And I don't even know what that is. Is that short for somebody like with an emotional disorder? I never really understood what the term emo meant, but it pretty much represents somebody that falls into the same goth category, G-O-T-H, right? Now, goth culture, right, just to kind of break it down a little bit, like, there was music, right? There was music that came with that, spawned, the music came, and around the music built a culture of styles and the way people did things, you know? It was all city stuff. It was all, you know, downtown Bowery type of stuff, but there was a wave of it in England, and there's a wave of it here in the States, just like pretty much everything gone, because what, these are English-speaking countries, right? And pop culture kind of builds up back and forth against each other, right? Getting past all that, goth culture, I'll just give you a little idea. Like, the music, I'm not going to describe to you. The music really is secondary. It's not the instruments that are used. There's a little bit of something to it. You've heard me talk about Black Sabbath, the original kind of doom rock, the stoner rock, where everything was kind of tuned down a little bit, you know, lower. So it had a muddier sound to it overall, and very distorted and everything like that. That gloominess is definitely an element of gothic rock, right? And gothic subgenres in general, all that kind of stuff. And probably more notable is the lyrical content, right? The lyrical content of the songs. It starts getting into social problems, right? Social injustices, emotional problems. It kind of left the rock and roll out of it, right? You get into this gothic rock, and it within the confines of post-punk, and it's kind of like a cultural movement that kind of separated itself from the rock. And of course you would, if you really understand what rock and roll is. It's teenager love music, right? It's dating. You know, Ralph and Potsy and Richie Cunningham at Arnold's asking a girl on a date, you know, and sharing a malt, you know. It starts like that, but it's all about that. It's about all those feelings and the expressions of the feelings in and about young love, young romance. And you know what happens when you get older? You're not young anymore, right? So you it's kind of strange for people who are older to be clinging to their teenage years and their youth. And the music isn't rock and roll anymore. It becomes some kind of other variant of rock as people get older and older, you know, without any grace. You know, they're not aging gracefully at all when they're hanging on to their past and, you know, trying to maintain images. Well, I'm getting a little bit off the track here, okay? But it's the lyrical content of the gothic music that divorces itself from rock. It's not rock. It's not singing about that teenage romance anymore. It's getting more in the lines of like, hey, daddy cheats on mommy, and Uncle Steve beats the shit out of me, and everything that's wrong with society that has this psychological impact on who? The people that make this shit and listen to this shit, right? And I mean, I can relate. You may have heard portions of my Downcome series, and it's talking about the darkness of my past. But I gotta tell you, I was never so dark that my life like became a masquerade party. And this is kind of what we're getting into. Let me explain. Like, there's styles that go with the music. It was a quote-unquote scene that built up around this gothic music, right? And here's what it's like, all right? I'm reading this off of Wikipedia, for whatever that's worth to you, but it's a starting place for people that don't quite know what I'm talking about, right? Gothic fashion, right? Talking about the styles built up around the culture of the music, of gothic music. Gothic fashion is marked by a conspicuously dark, antiquated, and homogeneous features. It is stereotyped as eerie, mysterious, complex, and exotic. A dark, sometimes morbid fashion and style of dress. Typical Gothic fashion includes colored black hair and black period-styled clothing. Both male and female Goths can wear dark eyeliner and dark fingernail polish, right? It starts to get a little bit gay, right? The dress-up party, most especially black. Styles are often borrowed from punk fashion and, more currently, from the Victorian and Elizabethan periods. It's also frequently expresses pagan, occult, or other religious imagery. Gothic fashion and styling may also feature silver jewelry and piercings, right? So it gives you a little bit of idea. This is the way people are walking around. And you've seen them. You go into the supermarket. You've seen somebody come in there. You know, it's the 4th of July and it looks like Halloween. It's, you know, like Morticia Adams, Lily Munster, that kind of stuff. From the 60s, right? This stuff did not just happen overnight. There was a vampire culture in the 60s and prior to that. But in the 60s, I know, as a kid, in my darkness, right, my dark teenage years as a kid, I basically traded my father out for the dead Jim Morrison to be the surrogate father of my life, right? When I couldn't get along with my father at all. And my Bible in those years was a book written by somebody who worked as part of the crew of the band The Doors, right? Danny Sugarman and some other guy's name I can't remember now. You'd think if it was a Bible, I'd remember it, but I don't. But it was called No One Here Gets Out Alive, right? Lyrics from the song 5-1 by The Doors. No one here gets out alive. And a big, fat, thick book, but it's biographical. It's primarily about Jim Morrison, but it also involved the other members of the band. But there was a story in there, right? Jim Morrison was a hoe dog. He was out with all kinds of women. He had his primary thing, the redheaded girl back in California, who was a heroin addict, who died shortly after he did. And then there was all this stuff that he picked up in his travels. And amongst his travels was, A, there was a Wiccan woman that he actually had a Wiccan wedding with, got married to, right? So he was basically maintaining two marriages at one point in his life. And that Wiccan thing was in New York City, if I remember right. But then the other thing that happened a little bit after that, there was a woman who was part of like this vampire blood drinking cult society. If I remember right, and I may not, forgive me if I don't, her name was just simply Nico. No last name or anything like that. She was some kind of celebrity, I guess you'd say, some kind of socialite in Manhattan, some kind of Euro trash, I think. And he had some kind of affair with this vampirical type of woman, and they drank blood. It was getting wasted in drinking blood. And, you know, that, and I use that word vampire. That's, to me, that's what it always was. See, I had the darkness inside of me, but I never got along with all that pretending I'm a ghoul. You know, I'm not, you know, I had periods in my life where I just dressed in black all the time. In fact, I dress in black mostly now as I sit here. I got black cowboy boots, a black belt, I got a black hat, a black jacket, and usually I have a black shirt. Today I have a gray one, right? I frequently dress in black, but I also have blue jeans, and sometimes I wear a gray shirt, right? So I'm not always like that, and I'm sure not dyeing my hair black. I'm not putting black nail polish on my fingers. I'm not avoiding the sun to stay as pearly white as I can be otherwise. So I look, what, dead? That's the whole idea of this stuff, right? So I'm going on and on and on and on about this stuff. And I guess there's a little lead up, but here's just a little understanding. You know, there's culture to this stuff. It goes back. In fact, I bring up the Doors. Why? Because the Doors are regarded by many people as kind of the granddaddy of the gothic rock, right? That whole dark and depressed and sullen expression, right? That's woven in and amongst all the psychedelic rock era, right? Where everything was kind of everything was flowers and hearts and peace signs, you know, peace, pot, microdot, all colorful and rainbowy and unicorns and butterflies. And then you had the Doors. That was just all darkness and death and incest and, you know, just a whole different ball game, right? A whole different ball game. A lot of people attribute what Jim Morrison and the Doors were doing to kind of spawning off this whole gothic thing. Though they didn't dress the part. They didn't, you know, dress up like Morticia Adams from the Adams Family or anything like that. They just were who they were, right? They didn't look the part, but they sounded the part. So anyway, all that to say, you know, I got some leftovers from prior episode, right? Because speaking on this line, you know, something struck me as I was going through that. I was doing a part about the character in The Breakfast Club, right? 1985 movie, again, from last episode. Or somebody had regarded me as like the living John Bender character, right? The wastoid character. And but there's other character in there that I kind of am familiar with, right? And it was this girl who would be described as goth now, but back in the 80s, I don't know exactly what you would pin it. You know, it was gothic, but what were we calling them back then? Vampires would be my word for it. Let me read, all right? If I could find this again, bear with me momentarily, as I dig this up. All right, going back to The Breakfast Club again, another character, and this character's name is, drum roll please, Allison Reynolds, okay? And I wouldn't know that unless I looked it up. I do not remember the movie. I just get the gist of it. Right. Allison is a, and I quote all this, by the way, Allison is a social outcast who dresses in black and acts in a way that would suggest she has a social disorder. She spends most of the first half of the film not speaking, occasionally piping up with spontaneous outbursts. As the story progresses, Allison opens up to Andrew about her difficult home life. Turns out that her attention-seeking behavior results from parental neglect, right? She also identifies herself as a compulsive liar, which is an interesting point. Because is she telling the truth or is she lying, right? What I want to get into, right, there's this person. Now, I'm not saying this person is me. I'm saying this person is the kind of person I got caught up with a couple of times in my life, right? And the compulsive liar part of it kind of registers with me, right? I don't want to get off into that, but there's a real aspect of that, right? Like the only truth a person could tell is that they're a liar, and you know, but And now you got this dark kind of girl, right? This dark girl has this fascination with everything related to death, you know, and darkness. The death, like the cemeteries, right? The pasty white skin, the pasty white makeup, the black eyeliner, everything to make a person look like the Walking Dead, right? I mentioned last episode and other episodes about the zombie element of our recent pop culture past like 10, 15 years, right? This whole big infusion of zombie this and zombie that. What you're talking about is Walking Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Living Dead, right? Living Dead. Though we had the Rob Zombie song called Living Dead Girl, right? Pretty good song. But anyway, let's move along from that. There's a lot to get to here in a short amount of time. So the fascination with death, right? The death and the darkness, the death of the cemeteries, and the way way a goth person presents him or herself as something that is actually dead walking around, right? This fascination with death is beyond the fascination. It's a romance of the death. And look, but me, my darkness was this suicidal voice kind of running me into the ground from early in my teenage years, quite a long way into my adulthood, right? The inner darkness, it begins with that. And then how we react to that is something else, right? Romancing death and things of the dead is part and parcel of suicidal ideation. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. That's what it is, right? So there's that death element, and the darkness element is... Well, let me put it this way, all right? My affiliation with this kind of person would be, talking about like old teenage rock and roll, and even into my adulthood a little bit too, right? In my 20s. Romantic interests who are these dark type of women, to even the point of some semblance of quote-unquote goth in their style, you know? One of them more so than another one of them, but both of them, just kind of not fall into it, right? There's a certain mystique when you're hooked up. There's a certain mystique about a woman that you're hooked up with who is... crazy. I'll just put it plain, okay? We're talking about sociopathic girlfriends. And I've been called a psycho magnet. I have history to prove it. Not to say that every woman who's come my way in my life has been a nut job, but there's been plenty of them. And there's been a variance in the particular type of nut jobs that they are, right? But I've had these kind of goth and borderline goth type of involvements. And I'm not going to pull any point. There's a mystique to them. And what the mystique is the darkness. And what the darkness is the secrets that these people carry, right? Now, when I hear the secrets, right, because all my years in AA, being sober, recovery, my mind automatically goes to the slogan, the phrase, you're only as sick as your secrets, right? So, you do the math. That means if you have secrets, it's a sickness. It makes you sick. It messes with your insides. It messes with your mind, what you're thinking, right? And if you think it through, you see exactly what I'm talking about, right? So, the person who is maintaining a whole lot of secrets ends up subsequently with a lot of sickness, right? And there's the craziness about it. There's a mystique. And what's the mystique? It's that darkness. And what's that darkness? It's that place where they hide all the shit that they don't want you to know, right? So when you're involved with somebody and you really care about somebody, what do? You kind of, you look at them and you learn them and you take them in. You dance with them and you learn how they move. And you learn what's at the core, you know? A lot of it happens just by osmosis, just by being around the person. And then some of it is with actual intent, you know. a passionate desire to actually want to know so much about a person for what? To be of the most use to that person, right? And my wife is a great example in a relationship. She knows more shit about me than my mother and me combined. I know she does. She knows my next move. Right? She cares like that. And I don't have a problem with that. Why? Because I don't have secrets, see? Now, the people that have problems, they got a lot of secrets. And the more secrets they get, the more darkness they have. The more darkness they have, the more mystique there is about them. They're mysterious. But that's not a good quality. If you have, if you're in a relationship with a mysterious person, you got problems coming your way, all right? You got problems coming your way. It's a bad thing. Yeah, it's stick around long enough, and you'll finally see what's behind the curtain, and what you're going to find, right, with these crazy girlfriends, is that they are crazy. Number one, and usually sluts. Okay, let's just be plain about it. That has been my finding, in those situations, right? Tornadoes that just run through the lives of people. You know, Tarzan swinging vine to vine through the jungle, making trouble for everybody, and trying to bury the secrets of their activities deeper and deeper in their heart and soul. And when you spend time with these people, it's the soul suck, right? I think I mentioned that. I might have even named an episode that, soul suck. You'd be around people who just drain the life and energy and strength out of you like a vampire sucking blood, really, right? There's more to this whole quote-unquote vampirism way of behaving than what is just physical, right? Yeah, you could dress like Bela Lugosi and make yourself look dead and listen to certain music and hang out in certain places and even drink blood, right? Even drink blood, like Nico in New York City and all that, right? You could do all that stuff. Those are physical attributes of it. But when you spend time around these kind of people and you actually have an affinity for any of them, whether friendship or romance, when you have a personal interest in somebody who's a soul suck, they suck your soul. And you walk around tired, drained. You know, drain like the vampire, just sucked all the blood out of you. But it's done in a psychic level, possibly a spiritual level, maybe both. You know, they're not really mutually exclusive. And I start thinking about that, I get negative. Am I dropping F-bombs? By the way, just a note here, I'm doing what I can to eliminate F-bombs. And I don't mean to go back and edit them out. I mean to not speak them, okay? I'm trying to do these episodes, hour and a half, whatever, without speaking that way, without drawing that kind of negative attitude into what I'm saying. I may talk about negative things, but I'm trying to stay a little bit more positive and upbeat about it, right? Telling some truths here, right? Telling them some truths. There might be some young person who just happens onto this someday who's got this crazy girlfriend. It could be a girl that has a crazy boyfriend. It goes both ways, right? I read you that description where even the men dress the same way and they use the nail polish and the makeup and all. And I said it was what? Yeah, a little bit gay, right? The masquerade party, right? I had the darkness. I didn't take it to the extreme of masquerade party about it. But anyway, my introduction to the fringes of goth culture in my life came when I was involved with a Wiccan, right? And a witch, and she had that darkness. And I remember when I was talking about the style and the culture, what I was reading out of Wikipedia before, what did it say? The stuff about paganism and the occult, right? And then it went into what? Being pathological liar. That's what this person was. Wiccan is all that to begin with, and then the lying part of it, well, that's a little dementedness in the psychological makeup of a person. But I know she was a liar because she got caught in the lies. You know, some of the people involved in her life kind of got together, compared notes, put two and two together, and found out exactly what her mystique was all about. And then it got really ugly, really ugly. Very interesting period of my life, you know. And, and she came equipped with like a soundtrack album, right? Right? This is my introduction to goth culture. Right? I said I was kind of peripheral on the fringes of it. through her, but I dove right into the heart of it when I went to a Nine Inch Nails concert, right? And that all started because of her. She brought Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails into my life, right? I didn't get along with it at first, right? The first album that was out, it was the first one that I heard, and she left it with me, and she wanted me to hear it, right? She wanted me to know it. She wanted me to absorb it. It's called Pretty Hate Machine. I think it's from like 88 or 89, right? The first Nine Inch Nails release. And, no, I should say full album release. I don't know. There might have been some EP or something. I don't know. Anyway, Pretty Hate Machine, late 80s. And I didn't like the music at first. Very digital, right? Very digital to me. Kind of, sort of club type of beat music. It wasn't my bag. There was one song that was kind of morose and out there. Very different. Something I Could Never Have, right? That was the song. I just want something I could never have. So I would listen to that because I thought that was really good. It kind of grabbed me. And then you know what happens. You find one song on an album that works for you. You start listening to that song, and all of a sudden you walk away from the room because you get interrupted. You come back, another song is playing, but you're busy, and you keep going. All of a sudden, another song grabs you, and then another. And then all of a sudden, I'm in the beat, I'm in the rhythm, I'm in the mood of it all. I get it. It's making sense to me. And then what happens? You start putting the words together, right? So I started to really like the Nine Inch Nails, and I became a humongous fan of it, you know, through the 90s, and then, you know, it petered off for me. But she, you know, Pretty Hate Machine, think of the words, Pretty Hate Machine. That's what she was. She was pretty and she generated hate. And she was hate. A very bad person. A very bad person. Just ugly insides. I can only imagine, you know, if you could see into a soul, how desolate that place must have been. You know, I don't have an idea where she's at now. But yeah, she was a Pretty Hate Machine, and the lyrics for that album. But I bring that up because I stepped into like the big goth party as a result of being a fan of Nine Inch Nails. Now, 1995, it's the year after what might have been their biggest, most popular album, Downward Spiral, right? And they were doing some kind of tour, possibly a tour after the tour that supported it. They toured in 94 and they came out in 95. They had a EP related to Down the Spiral called Further Down the Spiral. And I had that. I had everything, right? On Nine Inch Nails, they released everything. They called it Halo 1, Halo 2, Halo 3. I had like through Halo, I don't know, 13 or 14. I don't remember. I still got a bunch of them. I don't listen to them hardly ever at all. I mean, years go by. But I went in 1995 to a concert, a Nine Inch Nails concert. It happened to be Nine Inch Nails ridiculously opening up for David Bowie, because David Bowie should have been the opening act. That's a whole nother story. And I don't care about him. It doesn't matter. I was never really a fan of his anyway. But I went and saw Nine Inch Nails at the Meadowlands up in Jersey. 1995 was September, if I remember right. September 1995, late in the year, with a guy I knew from AA. We both went. It was like a sober concert. My God. It was, they called it the Self-Destruct Tour. Right? Go figure, right? Gothic and everything I'm talking about. It was a Self-Destruct Tour. And, oh, it was so loud. It opened up. I think it was Terrible Lie from Pretty Hate Machine, right? Talking about my terrible liar, the old witch, right? It was so loud. The first couple, bam, bam. These amplifiers that they had hanging in a rafter. We were up in the nosebleeds for it. Yeah. But anyway, that was, it was so loud. Blew my brains out. Good. They were very good. They were at their peak, their height, the highest popularity. Everything was just right. That was a very good time to see them in action. And it started to decline after that, right? So I was fortunate to get to see that when I did. Yeah, there was a lot of, see, Nine Inch Nails was gothic, but they kind of labeled it as like industrial rock, right? Industrial sort of metal, industrial rock. The culture around it was very goth, but the music itself, it was very digital. It was kind of hard. It was somewhere between punk and metal. It was really neither. It was definitely its own thing. Right? It kind of spawned a genre without much of a name. They referred to it as industrial, and a lot of that, I think, is probably the rhythms, the sounds and the rhythms that sounded like machinery. They sounded very mechanical because they were. They were digital, you know? And but they weren't the only expression of goth culture in the 80s and the 90s. You know, you had like there were more gothic type of bands that were punkish. There were more gothic type of bands that were equally digital and industrial. Ministry comes to mind. And then you had like metal type of goth, which was a natural, right? Which streams out of early Black Sabbath, which I talk about frequently, right? Black Sabbath was the granddaddy of the doom metal and the gothic metal and stoner metal. You know, there's a whole lot of different types of metal evolve out of the spark that Black Sabbath and Ozzy Osbourne lit off in the early 70s, you know. No doubt, like their first four albums were extremely influential. And I got to tell you, you know, going through the 90s and listening to Nine Inch Nails and being a big fan as I'd become of it, I think it was a natural for me to eventually find something a little heavier, right? Because I like the heavier music to begin with. And I remember hearing Typo Negative, right? They had basically one song. There was a watered down, shortened down version of a long, like a 10 or 11 minute song that they had for the radio, right? It was Black Number One. And man, did they have a thing? They had a sound. The guitar, Typo Negative, right? The name of the band. Think about that. It's a blood type, right? And it's vampirical and goth. The guy, the vocals, it just sounds like a vampire in a lot of cases, right? But really, the sound of the guitar, the distortion, was just tremendous. I would love to emulate that and just make that part of my sound. It was great. It was just really good. They made a bunch of albums. I had two of them. The first two were very popular, and those were the ones I had. And their big song was this song called Black Number One, right? And then kind of in parentheses, Little Miss Scarol, right? So you're having this song, you're talking about this exact type of goth crazy bitch. They describe it as I go through here, right? Black Number One is a reference to hair dye, right? It's the color, Black Number One. There's varieties of blackness, I guess. This is number one. And that's what the goth people buy and dye their hair with. Black, 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 number one. And the lyrics are all about this crazy girl and the way she does things. And a lot of the song lyrics are Typo Negative uses. It's weird. It's weird. The singer, right? Guy's like 6'8", all muscle bound, big lifter, Brooklyn dude, right? The band's out of Brooklyn, so they're a bunch of tough guys. They ain't no pussies, you know? They ain't what you would think when you think of a goth or emo. Nah, these are big, badass Brooklyn dudes. And the singer, bass player guy was huge, enormous, big, macho man. And these songs are about him basically being crippled internally by a girl or some different girls, like these women in his life. This is like the soul suck I was talking about. It don't matter how big and strong you were. Shit, I was big and strong when I had some of this stuff happening to me in my life, right? I hear that. I hear what's going on in his vocals, and I could see what's going on in his life, how he's involved with this psycho bitch, and he doesn't know how to make any sense of it, and it's really tearing him up, you know? But at the same time, he's a big, strong guy, and he pulls himself together, you know, trying to stiffen up the backbone a little bit, and it comes out with this real metal edge. The music is very bouncy. It goes back. The Doors, here we go again with the Doors. They got Doors keyboards in it, right? Adams Family again, the Adams Family feel, like the music that they use in the Adams Family. They take that from that show and they incorporate it and put this superior, heavy, droning distortion on. It's crazy. It's really slow. You know, it's not really upbeat. It's slow tempo music the sound is, I like it, you know. Black Number One was a thing. Black Number One is funny because you know, that has actual pertinence in my recollection, right? Memory. Once upon a time, somewhere after the, not long after, but somewhere after the Wiccan girlfriend, there was a stripper girlfriend, right? Go figure. Me? Yeah. Right? It happens. Life is life. And we take these avenues. So she was a stripper, and she'd get up on stage, and me and our friends, it was our custom to piss her off, to really bust her chops. And what we would do is we'd go to the DJ in the place and we'd request the long version of Black Number One. It's not danceable. And it's, like I said, 11 minutes long. What do, you know? The girls are supposed to go up there for like 2-3 songs or whatever their schedule is, and then they go off on a break. Off on the break, they're doing coke and, you know, whatever. They don't want 11-minute songs because then they got to be up there for 11 minutes, you know, and it pissed her off. And you know what? In retrospect, I'm glad. Because she was everything I'm talking about. Crazy bitch. A slut, you know. And that's where it all went. Go figure. But it did. And so when I hear that song, and I do. I hear that song from time to time. I go looking for it on purpose. I love the sound of it. I really do, you know. It's like a real serious doom metal version of the Doors, and it kind of works for me, right? Not in all my moods, but in some of them. But yeah, Black Number One, right? Little Miss Scare-All, the stripper girlfriend. We don't, you know, I remember about her. Weird, you know. They rented a place, her and her friends, and in her room on one wall, she just had all these ghosts, like little Casper the Friendly Ghost cutouts, right? All stuck up on the wall. The whole wall covered with them, right? They all had little names on them written. And what they were dead people. It's like every dead person that she can imagine got a little ghost on the wall, right? And this is part of that infatuation, the romanticizing of death and dead things that goth people have, right? And it's like, you know, I think about when I was a kid how I collected baseball cards, right? You collected baseball cards, you sort them out by team, whatever you do. And now here's like the girl, here's like the goth girl version of collecting baseball cards is like collecting, you know, dead people, right? Collecting dead people. And I make light of that because I kind of know what that feeling was, right? That's, like I said, that's romancing the dead. I have my own version of actually collecting the dead. And it's not a thing of darkness. It's a thing of light. Right? Now I collect the dead. And let me explain that to you. There's a, I guess you call it a discipline, right? If you do it on a routine basis. A discipline in Holy Orthodoxy involving prayers for the dead, right? We pray for the dead. And it's a very, very important manner. Important matter. Orthodoxy sees the hereafter, the afterlife, in a quite different manner than, say, Roman Catholicism or Protestantism in general. With Orthodoxy, we look at dying, right? What we call dying. I'm alive now, and if I die tonight, then I'm dead, right? And I'm in dead hereafter. So that's Scripture regards as the first death. There's a second death also, but that's the first death, right? The journey of redemption does not end with death. Protestants generally will think differently. It's instant heaven or instant hell, depending on your faith in your life, right? Roman Catholicism is pretty much the same. See, that's a Western ideology, but they have the significant difference of purgatory involved. Purgatory is where you're kind of caught in an in-between state, not quite good enough, not polished enough for heaven, but not heinous enough for hell. So there's kind of like this in-between place called purgatory, where you purge the remainder of your evil, right? That's the general perspective, the general view of death, the afterlife, the hereafter in Roman Catholicism. Orthodoxy, there really isn't a doctrinal standard. There's some good ideas spoken of by revered saints. The general consensus is for sure, however, that it is an ongoing journey of redemption, you know. And why this matters and why I'm bringing this up right now is because for some people, perhaps everybody, the ability to avoid that second death, like I mentioned, is completely dependent, or I should say maybe completely dependent, on the prayers of others, right? We're in our spirit state, bodiless, formless, don't know exactly what that's like. We get a picture in the Gospels from Jesus when he tells the story about Lazarus and the rich man, of two, really three distinct places in the realm of the afterlife, right? Hades in general, Hades as a whole, right? One side of it, you have comfort. That's where poor Lazarus ends up after a whole lifetime of hardship and homelessness, begging. But his faith brought him to the bosom of Abraham. And on the other side, you got a place of torment where the rich man ends up, because he was self-reliant and he had no regard for the trouble of other people. But there's a place of torment, there's a place of comfort. In between that, there's a large chasm that can't be crossed. I think technically the side of torment is set lower than the side of comfort as well. But though the chasm can't be crossed, one can see from one side to another and hear from one side to another, right? So that's a general picture of what the afterlife looks like according to the story of the rich man and Lazarus, Lazarus and the rich man. So you have people that are tormented after the first death. You have people that are not. They have a comfortable afterlife, right? Now, Orthodoxy would say that all of these people have a shot at being fully redeemed and avoiding the second death. Our prayers come in here. Our prayers for those in comfort will keep those people in comfort as they are finished off, polished off. This is a matter of sanctification, right? on the tormented side, they're tormented by heat and by fire. It's a refiner's fire. It's taking those who of us who refused, absolutely refused to come to faith, who refused Jesus Christ, who refused to change from evil and to good, right? The repentance. And now they are in a spirit condition, still very much in need of this redemption. And if the torment don't cause them to move in that direction, they end up at the second death, which is eternal damnation in the lake of fire, right? It gets very complex very quick, and I can't tell you that I have like a firm grasp on everything perfectly. Priests will even disagree, and these are highly trained people, right? But the general gist is that a lot of the activity of souls in the afterlife is completely dependent upon prayers of others, right? So, say you die and you're not saved, your soul is not redeemed, you are cast off into a torment. You may well be stuck there unless you got somebody like me praying for you to get through it, to move out, to get an offer of redemption, right? To be given a clear pathway to move, to give you passage. There's this thing in Orthodoxy, and again, this is debated too. Some kind of saint, I think it may have been a female saint, whatever that's worth. I'm trying to remember, I'm trying to stir my head that maybe the name will pop up. But somebody had a vision of what it looks like in the afterlife, and it involves this thing that's known as the Orthodox toll houses. Now, a lot of people dispute it, disagree with it. It's not doctrinal, it's an idea. It's a way to look at some things. My problem with the toll houses is, what it is you basically got like a ladder or a stairway, some kind of pathway of redemption that's carrying you from this life here to the life beyond, an eternity, right? You got this intermediate place, the place of the dead, the afterlife, as we know it to be, Hades, you might call it, Greek. And along your journey, up the ladder or up the stairway, whatever, however you want to look at it, you're being tormented the whole time. You got all these forces of evil tormenting you, trying to run you off the side, down into the flames where you have to start all over and try to climb again. But and then on the way, there's these toll houses that you can pass only if you meet certain requirements. And a lot of that requires prayers of others. So your life here in this world is reflected by the way people remember you and revere you. And which people remember and revere you, right? Yeah, and these prayers come in, and it helps you to be protected on the way and to have safe passage through these toll houses. And it's like that. See, my problem is that we have people that are in torment, there are people in comfort. The people in comfort have already shown some sign of redemption. They've been sanctified to some degree already. And it wouldn't be comfortable if they had to endure this whole toll house situation, right? So it kind of defies that story with comfort and torment Jesus tells in the Bible of Lazarus and the rich man. But I could see where toll houses or something similar could apply to those people who are in torment in the afterlife. Do you follow that? That makes sense to me. Hey, but exactly what that looks like, who can say? But it does make sense. And now these people, if they want to pass to be refined, right, the refiner's fire of sanctification, they're going to depend on us left behind who remember them and pray for them, lest they have no chance of making it through to the end. So it's very important, right? So, so I now collect the dead. And what I do is I look for as many people to pray for who are dead that I can do, right? Everybody who I know that is dead, I met personally, and even a couple of people that I never did get to meet personally. I have a great-grandfather, for example, who I never got to meet. He died young. I mentioned about the coal miner, right? He died in some kind of coal mining accident in Pennsylvania. He was in his 40s or something, or happened in the 40s. I never got to know him, right? And my great-grandmother ended up remarrying somebody else, and da-da-da-da, a whole different story. So this guy kind of got buried in the back pages of the family history. I never knew his name or anything about him until only a couple of months ago, and it's only because I asked. And then I went to research, did some research about it, right? But anyway, I include him. Because I just do. I don't know. Somewhere in my heart, that's fine. I got an aunt and an uncle that I never met on my father's side, who died before I was born. But I've always heard stories about them, so I remember them in my prayers. But generally, otherwise, it's people who I have known through my life. And you'd be surprised, the people who I remember having had known, you know? People who are related to you. I got all these different categories, or I got all these different categories of people that I pray for to help me remember as I go through. And now, as far as the dead is concerned, I've actually just started, I typed it up, and I got a list to make it go a little bit easier. So where I'm thorough, I'm quicker. Yeah, it takes a lot of time. Right now, the names are, there are 139 names on the list, right? 139. And I do this 5 days a week, generally. It's workday stuff, right? And I do more on the weekends in a different kind of way. Maybe I'll get to that. But I will get to that, in fact. I will. Why not? This is a very good place. Now, I mentioned that I'm an acolyte, right? I serve at the altar in our church. And part of what I do at our liturgies, or our liturgical services on Sunday mornings, is I get what's called the quote-unquote names. And what the names are lists. That it's kind of Russian and Eastern European tradition, right? The Slavic countries. But it's basically a Russian thing, perhaps a Ukrainian thing, a Serbian thing like that, where they list out names on a piece of paper. One side of the paper is prayers request, or the request for prayers for the health of certain people, and then you flip it over to the other side. It's prayers for those who are quote unquote in repose, right? So we're praying for the dead. Who's we? Well, it's me and then the priest, right? I get these names and then I pray for all of these. And it could be another 140 people, right? Or more. I never really count it. I just get them and go. And that's part of the role I do. And when I do that, then I put them on the side and the priests do some things and then I get them back and then I do some things. And, you know, it's just stuff, and I don't need to get in all the details of it, but that praying continues through the weekend, right, for the dead. So 6 days out of seven, I'm doing a lot of praying for people who have passed on. It's a part of my life, like I said, a part of my discipline. It's kind of funny because, well, not funny, but a cool thing. It's a cool thing about being an acolyte in my church. The Orthodoxy. We got a lot of kids, right? And these kids, they're from all over the world, right? The parents who are immigrants and things like that, these kids, they're really Orthodox and they're actually very highly trained up. They'll be 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, like in that range. Kids, you know, kids, children, not teens, right? Kids. They know more than I know about church stuff. I learn from them while I'm up there, right? And there's this one in particular. He's a little guy, right? I call him Pooty Poot. He looks like a miniature Vladimir Putin, who's, of course, miniature to begin with himself, right? He's a short guy. But this guy has kind of similar features to Vladimir Putin. And so he's like the little Putin, and I just call him Pooty Poot, right? My wife laughs when I say that. I tell this, and I say it. I think it so frequently, and I say it frequently enough that it just comes out. You know, I'm not saying anything outrageous or weird or new. It's just, it rolls normally out of my mouth, and then my wife just starts cracking up. And he's Pooty Poot, but he's a really good kid, right? Good young guy, and I like him. I like him. And he's the guy who, he comes up to me like 2 or 3 times on Sunday morning, all excited, right? He's like, should I go get you some more names? Right? They're kept like in the lobby area. People, there's like a notepad and cards and things like that, pens and pencils. And they stack them up out there. And this kid will go out there 2, 3, 4 times, pull in the names and bring them to me, you know? And I'm just like, all right, yeah, if you want to, you know? He's very excited about it. It's a big deal. I was not raised that way. I was not raised any of these ways. Praying for the dead, when I was in the process of converting into Orthodoxy, was a very foreign thing for me. You didn't do it, especially out of the Protestant discipline, or I should say the Protestant lack of discipline, right? The dead were dead, right? The good guys went to heaven, the bad guys went to hell, and that's the end of that. There's nothing you can do about it. There's no intervention. God's not hearing your ear on that. Judgment's decided, right? Of course, that's a little bit weird because there's a final judgment. So why is there two judgments? And I don't know. I don't need to get into all that, but I do got me this Pootie Poot, and like I said, he's like a miniature Vladimir Putin. And Vladimir Putin. I'm a fan of Vladimir Putin, right? I've got this Ukrainian background, but I favor Russia and all this mess in the world. And all this mess in the world, Russia, especially Vladimir Putin, he's the one who's standing up for the multipolarity of human civilization as opposed to the unipolarity that is represented by this Western liberal globalist, these weirdos, right, who have corrupted this country. Right? They've corrupted the politicians that run the Federation, these D.C. scumbags. Half the world can't stand, probably more than half the world can't stand the United States. But what it is that they don't like is the Federation. They don't like the federal government. They don't like what's going on in Washington, D.C. We're just people. We're just citizens, right? But the globalist element has corrupted the federal leadership of this country, owns it, has it bent over. Hey, that's what Jeffrey Epstein's all about, right? The honeypot things. These people are blackmailed and they're bought and sold, the corporate greed, all this shit. It's just so ugly, right? It's about to get tore apart. It's going to be, like I said earlier, many earlier episodes. 2024 is going to be a tumultuous year, and it's already starting, right? Post Arlen's about Texas. What's going on in Texas right now? What's going on in Texas right now, right? We got that border invasion. We got the state trying to stand up for itself against the federal government, against Washington, D.C. And it's starting to come to a head. People are starting to have talk about civil war. All these other states are starting to get behind Texas, and it's starting to lay out like north and south. It's looking like it's all going to come down again. And you know what? This time around, the South, Texas is going to be on the right side of history. Putin is on the right side of history. And in this, the good news is this corrupt DC bullshit, this scumbaggery and faggotry and all the kind of weirdness, the pedophilia, the blackmail, it's all dying. It's all dying. These people are going to get fleshed out one way or another, you know, and their handlers too, all right? Not just quote-unquote their handlers. This episode has been talking about this infatuation with death and romanticizing death, you know. This is death worth romancing. The death of the D.C. federal bureaucracy and scumbag criminality.
Thank you for tuning into Post Arlen Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.